with Senate Bill 19A. Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 19A comes to you from the Senate Judiciary. This bill deals with the issue of youth who, well, it basically deals with our definitions in the juvenile code that we use for people who are in juvenile detention and in juvenile, once that they turn 18, the question becomes, can that person who is now 18 be held in an adult facility? There have been some question about that. This statute answers that, yes, that they could, and some certain findings need to be found. And I think that Larry Oglesby signed up. He is for the bill. And Ms. McFarland is here from Juvenile Rights Project. She's probably more against the bill. And we'll be able to, I hope the two of them will be able to outline some of the issues that brought this bill to being. And I also believe there might be another amendment that Mr. Travis and I looked at to the A. N. Gross bill, a technical amendment. And then also, it's my understanding that there's a two amendment that I didn't have yet, but I believe it's Teresa Miller or JRP can explain that amendment.
You're not trying to get me confused, are you?
That was a lot of talking. I should have just been quiet.
Been fine. All right, let's call Mr. Oglesby and Ms. McFarland up, if you will. And Tim? Great. Who would like to lead out? Ms. McFarland?
Okay, thank you. Representative Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project represents children in juvenile court, including the children affected by this bill, delinquents who either have been adjudicated in juvenile court and are on probation or who are awaiting adjudication at the time they turn 18. Basically, what we would like the committee to do is to correct sort of the definitional semantic problem that has arisen as a result of a county council opinion in Multnomah County and an appellate case, and to not take what we regard as the further step and allow for these individuals who have been adjudicated or are awaiting juvenile adjudication to be placed in adult jails. The argument against doing that is both a public policy argument and a constitutional argument. So we believe that if Senate Bill 19A were passed as it is, that it would be unconstitutional and would face challenges. The reason for this is that juveniles, when they're adjudicated in juvenile court, do not have the same due process rights as adults. They don't have a right to jury trial. They don't have a right to bail. They don't have a right to grand jury. The reason that that is okay and constitutional, according to all of the case law and even our statutes, is that we have special solicitude for juveniles in juvenile court. They have a right to treatment, and that distinguishes them from adults who have committed crimes and allows for that disparate treatment in terms of due process. If we now decide after the fact, after a juvenile has been adjudicated or at least taken the first step into the juvenile system and is awaiting adjudication, to treat them more as an adult by incarcerating them in an adult jail, then we're not providing that special substitute, and we either must provide jury trial, bail, and grand jury for those individuals. In other words, try them as adults if you're going to incarcerate them as adults, or we must keep them in the juvenile system. And we believe that it is better practice to keep them in the juvenile system. One of the reasons is that these are actually kind of two fairly small groups of juveniles that we're talking about here, the pretrial detainees and juveniles who are on probation and facing a minor probation violation for which they might be held in custody. But we believe that those individuals are better held in a juvenile detention facility than in an adult jail because they have already, they're already at some point in their probation. They have been already being treated as a juvenile. They have committed a probation violation for which we agree they should have a consequence and perhaps even the consequence of being detained. But to then place them, kind of put them on a higher level, place them into an adult jail, first of all, gives them a message that, you know, they're no longer being treated as a juvenile, and secondly, allows them to associate with older criminals, and that is not going to be a good thing. These are kids who, while they've made a mistake on probation, are not necessarily kids who are headed down that path. If they were headed down that path and they were 18, after their 18th birthday, they would be being adjudicated. Everything they commit after 18, they are adjudicated as adults. So these are just kids who have were on juvenile probation and have screwed up on that somehow, and they need a consequence. We think the appropriate consequence is in juvenile detention, not in adult jails.
Mr. Oglesby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You have my written testimony. I'll just paraphrase a little bit of it. To kind of give an example of who we're dealing with, I list three potential examples. One is a youth who commits an offense prior to the 18th birthday but is not arrested and charged until after they turn 18, so they're still under the juvenile court jurisdiction for when the offense was occurred. The second one is where a youth is charged with an offense at age 17 and then turns 18 during the proceedings in juvenile court, and the court finds that that youth needs to be incarcerated. And then the third example that I list is a youth who is on probation in juvenile court who turns 18 and then violations of conditions of probation, and the court sanctions that youth for a variety of reasons. So there's a variety of those. In all cases, the people we're talking about here are, in fact, 18 years of age. For any subsequent behavior that they would be involved with, they would be considered an adult, tried as an adult, given all the protections of the adult system. And it's only for purposes of incarceration that they don't have all of the protections of the juvenile system, which is, as McFarlane points out, is a different system looking at different goals than the adult system. Some of the youth who we're talking about would in fact be appropriate for detention, most appropriate in detention, given their maturity, their age, their size, their ability to function, and a judge under this bill would have the ability to determine those should be placed in juvenile detention. Likewise, there are a number of others who at age 18, for all intents and purposes, are adults and may have been for some time in relationship to all the factors that a judge would review. The judge would make that determination based on a court hearing and looking and making certain findings that this was in the best interest of this youth to be placed, this youth offender to be placed either in jail or in detention. So this would give the flexibility for the courts to make that determination. Prior to the Court of Appeals decision a couple of years ago, it was a fairly common practice in many counties to place these youth in jail on their 18th birthday or any time after they were 18. That's true in some, but not in all counties. So this gives the flexibility for, this bill would give the flexibility for the court to make that determination and determine what makes the most sense for the kid and for justice.
Thank you. Mr. Travis.
First, let me say how uncomfortable it is to sit here and be in opposition to a person who's probably responsible for my knowing anything about juvenile law at all. Julie was my mentor for a number of years when I worked for the Juvenile Rights Project, and although I'm not in agreement with her today, I will always be grateful for the contribution she's made to my career and to Children of Oregon. She's truly a giant figure. Julie's testimony, I think, hit most of the high points of my testimony, which you have in front of you. I would just point out that on the second page, about halfway down, the question says, why is it a concern if someone over the age of 18 and prosecuted under ORS 419C, that is the juvenile code, is locked up with other people over the age of 18 who are prosecuted under criminal law? And the answer is that it's a violation of their constitutional rights, as Julie has said. And the next question down says, how does Senate Bill 19 ensure that the treatment needs of these people will be met, even though they're lodged in a jail? And the answer is that all youths and youth offenders will have a hearing. They do have a hearing now to determine whether they'll be held. And at that hearing, the court must make a finding, in addition to all the other findings that the court has to make, that the needs of the child, the youth, will be met with that incarceration. And that's really the crux. That's really the crux. As I review Ms. McFarlane's testimony, I guess it boils down to the fact that policies changed. The Tewksbury case, which she cites, is 20 years old. It's an FSUP case. It never went higher than the district court. We are talking not about 1982. We're talking about the post-Senate Bill 1 age. We're talking about a time in which the policy in delinquency law has changed. Parens patriae, the idea of the state as the parent of the child, is no longer the law in Oregon. That was done away with by Senate Bill 1. So a reliance on an image of a system in which we're dealing with children is no longer public policy in Oregon. The best interest of the child is now balanced with accountability and public safety when we're dealing with juvenile delinquents in Oregon. It's no longer the single concern of best interest of the child as it was when Tewksbury was the law. Tewksbury was based on the federal constitution. It's interesting to read the language of Tewksbury that's in Ms. McFarlane's testimony because it talks about children. It doesn't talk about youths and youth offenders. The Columbia County Jail, in which the plaintiffs in Tewksbury were incarcerated, Ms. McFarlane could tell you stories about the terrible conditions in that jail, including backed up sewers in which children were incarcerated in dirty sewage water on the floor. But the finding that the judge has to make under Senate Bill 19 ensures that the needs of this particular youth offender will be met if they're incarcerated in a place where adults can be held. And if those needs cannot be met in that place where adults are held, then they're not going to be placed there. And these are people who will all have lawyers at that hearing to argue the needs of their particular client vis-a-vis the facility that they're going to be placed in. We're talking about 18-year-olds. All of these quotes through here talk about children and parents patriae. That's not the picture that we're talking about here. We're talking about 18-year-old people in a different climate, a different public policy toward juvenile crime. Ms. McFarlane, on the fourth page of her testimony, says, if the state wishes, it's in bold language halfway down, it's a quote from an Oregon Supreme Court case. It says, if the state wishes to prosecute a child criminally, it must do so by transferring that child into criminal court. We're not talking about prosecuting anybody in criminal court. The prosecution remains in juvenile court. The punishment that's possible remains limited by the juvenile court statutes. It's still 8 days in detention. That's all it is. We're not bootstrapping anybody into adult court. We're merely moving the site of their detention from a juvenile facility to a facility where adults can be held. Also, I want to say on the fourth page at the bottom, Ms. McFarlane says that it would be totally possible if you had a juvenile, a youth offender who had violated probation, that instead of sending that youth offender to an adult facility, we could instead send them to a youth correctional facility. Well, we could, except they're all being closed. We do not have bed space at youth correctional facilities for people who violate their probation on a low level. Plus the fact, probably what's going on here is somebody's violated their probation and they're going to get between 1 and 8 days as a consequence. If between one and eight days is an appropriate consequence for a probation violation, sending somebody to a youth correction facility with the OYA is certainly an overreaction in that circumstance. Now, Ms. McFarlane, on the fifth page of her testimony, says that there's unfettered discretion by the judge. That's simply not the case. There is not unfettered discretion. The judge must, as I say, make a finding that the rehabilitative needs of the youth will be met in the adult facility. So I'm saying that in her paragraph where she says there are no real restrictions is simply not the fact. The judge has standards. The youth has counsel. It's really not the case that services don't exist in adult facilities. They do, and if they're not up to snuff for juveniles, then the judge doesn't have to order them to go there. I regret that I didn't have a chance to really more thoroughly brief the objections that Ms. McFarlane has, but I would like to say one more thing. This is not simply a Multnomah County problem. And it's not simply a problem that arose because of this case that Ms. McFarlane quotes. There are very many judges in Oregon who want to be able to consequence kids over the age of 18 for probation violations. They don't want to charge them as adults to be able to consequence them. And they also don't want to take up valuable and rare juvenile detention space for these kids who are going to be there for a couple of days. So this is, it's more than just, as my testimony says, it's more than just a county council who doesn't really understand juvenile law opining incorrectly about what an adult is. It's also a very real need felt by judges in Oregon for a way to deal effectively with these older kids who need a minimum consequence, and so that they don't have to overreact and take up a lot of extra space that's needed for other kids. And with that, I'd be pleased to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Prosansky.
Mr. Chair. Tim, if I heard your testimony correct, the maximum that any of these young people can receive in the way of a sanction for the contempt or being in probation, violation of probation, is 8 days?
That's correct.
Incarcerated?
That's correct.
What else besides incarceration? Is there monetary sanctions that could be imposed?
They can be asked to do community service. Can they be fined for a probation violation? They can be fined for a probation violation. They can do service for a victim. There's a number of things that can happen.
Okay, thank
you.
They
can be put on house arrest.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. McFarlane, one of the things that concerns me about this is somebody violating the probation. Committee went out to McLaren a while back, and we talked to one kid who's going to be there. He'll be in prison in 2053, and we asked a number of them, what would you do different in your life? They mostly were Major 11 felons, and every one of them said, well, I would have structure, more structure and consequences. I never had consequences. They would always threaten me. Never happened until Measure 11, which they couldn't get around. And so, I would think if I'm the judge, I might be getting tired of an 18-year-old who's not paying attention. And I'm not having a problem seeing an 18-year-old go to adult jail for a week.
Well, Representative Barker, it's not just a question of going for 8 days for probation violation, because this bill also allows pretrial detention, which can be lengthy. In an adult jail. But as far as consequences, juveniles can be detained in juvenile detention facility for probation violation. And so they can be incarcerated, and they're going to be incarcerated in a place where, in fact, they're going to actually have to do some stuff to address what they did wrong or what they're not complying with their probation. In Multnomah County, for instance, there are a lot of different programs for probation violators. So we have like a forest project where you go and have to work up in the woods, quite difficult, heavy labor kind of thing. We have restitution programs. You can, if your probation violation is that you're not paying your restitution, you can be in detention like at night and then go out during the day and work on public works kinds of projects, and you receive money that goes to pay your restitution for that. So it's a much more positive thing than merely throwing them in an adult jail. And, I I fully expect that if this passes, we will have judges who will be, you know, using it as a threat, will be saying, you know, I have the choice. I can lock you up in an adult jail, or I can lock you up in juvenile detention, and we'll be trying to scare kids. And then when kids do what kids do, which is not be terribly impressed sometimes by what adults tell them, which is normal developmentally, then judges will feel that they have to follow through, and you will have kids in adult jails who are not appropriate to be there. And I want to point out that the language of the bill doesn't say that just because the judge finds that the facility cannot meet the needs of the youth, that the judge cannot place the youth there. All that has to happen is for youth to be placed in an adult facility is that they're over 18. And then it says the judge may place them there. And so findings are, you know, juvenile law is full of findings, often not made, I might add, as an experienced practitioner, and pretty worthless in a lot of circumstances. So I'm not impressed that there are findings in this bill. It's cheap, and it's not a real response to the concern that children who are inappropriate, young adults who are inappropriate to be in jail, where they will only be learning negative things, not participating in constructive activities to address their probation violations, and, of course, the concern that I listed in my written testimony that, again, we will see, because there's discretion and not really clear guidelines, that we will see, again, the minority overrepresentation problem.
But if they're 18 or adults, and they continue to violate, I mean, I think this law gives the judge the discretion they probably need. I mean, I'm having trouble seeing your side of it when there is the discretion. Oh, maybe that's the problem that you're worried about. And I remember the Columbia County Jail before the Tewksbury decision. So, but anyway, okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be reminded, what is the age of majority in Oregon?
It's 18.
Thank you. And Ms. McFarland, you mentioned better practices by having these adults that are 18 go to a juvenile facility as opposed to an adult facility. But what's the evidence-based practices suggest that we do? I mean, I understand, you know, there's a difference between a best practice and an evidence-based practice, and I'm just curious what the evidence-based practice would suggest.
And I didn't, excuse me, I didn't bring that specific information. I can tell you that is available, and there's actually a lot of study, because back when Senate Bill 1 was passing, there was a lot of question, what is the efficacy of the juvenile court? Does it work? And there are, in fact, a lot of studies that talk about why the practices in juvenile court work. One thing that I think is probably pretty readily available is the recovery of restitution. And those programs run through detention that help recover restitution, you know, concretely benefit the individual youth who's in there as well as the victim and society in general. There also are community services projects that are run through the juvenile department as well. But there's been actually quite a lot of study, and I don't have those studies at my fingertip to give you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have each of you seen the amendments proposed to the Engross bill? Do you have any comments? Or
Mr. Chair, I saw them early this afternoon. I guess my comment would be it pretty much takes away the intent of the bill in terms of giving the court the discretion to make the right choice in terms of which place to place these youth. With regard to reasons why the court may use that discretion, the issue of restitution, which was raised, is one of those reasons that our court has done that in the past. It's amazing what happens when a youth offender who turns 18 and has has been very truculent in paying their restitution, then finds the judge saying, well, you could spend some time in jail. It's amazing how quickly that restitution gets paid. So I think there's some positive benefits to that. The other thing is these are 18 and older youth, sometimes are older, who remain on probation. And small facilities around the state, small detention centers, unlike the ones in Multnomah County and other places, have a very difficult time keeping that older youth separated from that 12-year-old in a small facility. So in terms of the program that's being able to be provided for that younger youth, that's really impinged by having the older youth there. And with regard to the evidence-based question, I would simply say that the research shows that programs that Ms. McFarland describes are effective in working with youth offenders. The problem is they're not in every county. They're not consistently available. And most of the youth that we're talking about who have turned 18 have been through every one of those programs. We have those in our county where you cut wood, where you do community service, where you pick up litter, or you do a variety of things. You may have been in detention numerous times, and most of those kids can do that standing on their head by the time they're 18 years of age.
Some of the kids who come into our system late, and by late we mean 16 and 17-year-olds, have never been in trouble before. But most of them who come in again at 16 and 17, they've been in the system for a while. And as Mr. Oglesby says, they've been around the block. This bill gives a judge the discretion to make a case-by-case determination. And I know what Ms. McFarland said about findings, but let me first say that there was never a case I'm aware of where findings had to be made that Ms. McFarland was representing the kid, that those findings didn't get made, because she, as an attorney for the kid, was there to make sure that those findings got made. And I did the same thing when I was representing young people. And the lawyers are there to make sure the findings do get made. I have more confidence in the judges than Ms. McFarlane has expressed today that she has. And I think the judge is the person who's on the ground, who sees the person, who hears the argument from the lawyers, who knows what facilities are there in the local community, and can make an informed and reasoned decision based on the mores of that particular community about how to place. I have seen Ms. McFarlane's amendments, and as far as they go, they're good, because they do clear up the problem that I explain in my paper about the difference between an adult and a juvenile. It's not what you think it is. It depends on which jurisdiction they're under. It doesn't depend on how old they are. But it doesn't go far enough in providing judges with a little bit of flexibility about what to do in cases where you have these people who are, in essence, adults, and you don't want to necessarily use up juvenile facilities to incarcerate them for a short period of time to get their attention or whatever. And Ms. McFarlane is right. I did neglect to mention that this bill does cover pre-adjudication detention as well, so that it could last up to 30 days, because most crimes that you can hold longer than 30 days pre-adjudication, you're not going to be hearing in juvenile court anymore. They're going to either be waived or they're going to be Measure 11 crimes. If a young person is held, if a person over the age of 18 is held on a juvenile charge in detention waiting for trial, they get a review every 10 days of the situation. So if a person over the age of 18 is inappropriately placed in a jail and there's no facilities there to meet their needs, every 10 days their lawyer gets an opportunity to go in and talk to the judge and to make a record about that detention and its inadequacy. So there are safeguards built into the system.
Thank you all.
I have a question,
Mr. Chair. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Representative Ackerman.
I was just going to say that the amendment that we need to make before we can move the bill, it needs to be made in section 4 of the bill on page 2 on line 35. The section 4, in which line 35 is the rule that says that young people can't be detained in a place where adults can be held. And line 35 creates an exception in the case of young people who have been already adjudicated. They've been, in essence, found guilty. What we didn't do is we forgot to add in here an exception for young people who are held pending trial. So on line 35, it will say, when detention is authorized by Section 2 of this 2003 Act, or by ORS 419C453, a youth or youth offender. And that will be the amendment. So it's a very technical amendment. We'll be sending that down to Legislative Council this afternoon.
Representative Ackerman.
Is the purpose of this bill to compensate for the lack of beds in juvenile detention facilities?
That is one of the purposes, yes.
My second question is the finding that the court must make regarding the, quote, specific needs, unquote, of the youth offender. Could a finding include that treatment alternatives are not viable for this person?
Is the question that treatment services available in a juvenile facility are not viable for this?
Not viable for the needs of the juvenile.
If I'm understanding the question, it probably could, yes. If I'm understanding the question.
So in other words, in some isolated cases, we're adopting a punishment standard for juvenile offenders based upon specific court findings.
One of the problems I always had when I was representing kids was this idea that punishment could be part of rehabilitation. But that was, I think, a myopic view that I had when I was representing kids. It's very well accepted within the literature of rehabilitating juvenile offenders that there is a place for punishment. It's not the sole agenda item, but that there is a place for it. And a judge could find that what this kid needs right now is, as Mr. Oglesby says, an incentive to pay his or her restitution, and therefore that's your need, and there you go. I mean, I can see that happening.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else would like to testify on Senate Bill 19? Hearing none, I'll close the hearing. Do we want to wait for some of the...
I think we should, yeah.
Okay. And you will bring, Ms. McFarland, you all will get together and bring back, we'll reschedule a work session. Thank you. Let's go 45. Okay. I'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 45 next.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, while I think Ann Christian is the only person signed up for that one, and while she's coming up to the dais, Senate Bill 45 deals with where a case can be heard for post-conviction relief, and it basically takes advantage of the fact that we have new technology that allows for video conferencing, and it would allow for a judge to hear the case without transferring venue, basically, if they have that technology in place. And I hope Ann can fill it in a little bit more than that.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm here today representing the Oregon Judicial Department as well as the Public Defense Services Commission. Senate Bill 45 was pre-session filed by the Judicial Department. It is the product of a work group that was comprised of judges, a representative from the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections represents generally superintendents of Department of Correction facilities who are named parties in post-conviction relief. The other member of the work group was a representative of the public defense attorneys who provide representation to generally inmates who seek post-conviction relief. And I can tell you today that the Department of Justice, who is on the other side, if you will, of representing in post-conviction relief cases, and a work group of the Public Defense Services Commission that has been put together on the specific issue of post-conviction relief, both support this bill, and there is no known opposition to the bill. As counsel indicated, there is new technology that is available to the court system, and the players within the court system are attempting every effort to make use of that technology. So one of the things that Senate Bill 45 does is codify and clarify that, in fact, appearances by counsel, by petitioners who can be inmates, and other witnesses in a post-conviction relief case can be made other than in person, so by telephone or by video. The second thing that Senate Bill 45 does, which as the Indigent Defense Services Director I particularly like, is the fact that currently when an inmate files post-conviction relief, they may be housed here in Salem, having only started to serve their incarceration sentence, and then they can be transferred, for example, to Malheur County or Eastern Oregon, Baker City, to the Powder River facility. And when that occurs, if they have filed post-conviction relief, there is no law currently with respect to what's called a motion to change venue, move that case that's already been filed in Marion County to east of the Cascade Mountains. And Senate Bill 45 would provide that the court has discretion to decide whether or not to send a case to the county where an inmate has been transferred. And with that, coupled with the enhanced ability to use technology, we believe will only create greater efficiencies within our court systems and within the public defense system. Since so many institutions have been built east of the Cascades, I know a significant issue for the Judicial Department and the judges in Eastern Oregon has been trying to keep up with a caseload that is quite difficult, quite frankly, called post-conviction relief, where inmates generally are challenging the effectiveness of their counsel on the original case. And we have had more and more difficulty with judicial resources, court resources, and I can speak personally to difficulties in locating attorneys in Eastern Oregon to handle these cases. So I would be happy to answer any questions. Again, I know of no opposition to this bill, and I would strongly ask for your support.
Does each county have closed-circuit television available now?
Mr. Chair, those counties where there is a DOC institution, my understanding is they all do have them. Now, the minute I say that, Coos County may not, but the big ones do.
Okay. Questions?
Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to make sure that I understand the bill here and your testimony. Are we saying that an inmate at Two Rivers in Umatilla for this post-conviction would be heard, if they were from Portland, that it would then be heard in Multnomah County again?
Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen, the answer to that question is it could be under current law. Maybe I should back up and say current law provides that a petition for post-conviction relief must be filed in the county where the inmate is incarcerated. So in your Two Rivers example, current law says that petition must be filed in Umatilla County. Current law does provide, however, that the court may move that case from Umatilla County to the county where the original case occurred. And that is in my written testimony. It's a reference to ORS 138560, where it says the court may transfer a case to the county of original conviction. So in your example, Multnomah County. If the hearing on the post-conviction relief petition, quote, can be more expeditiously conducted. What Senate Bill 45 addresses is when that inmate in Umatilla County, who was convicted in Multnomah County, is transferred to Malheur County. And in that scenario, currently, judges frequently, because there is no law with regard to whether or not to move the case to Malheur, judges will frequently change venue to Malheur County. The court in Malheur then opens a new case file, a new judge is put on the case, and frequently a new attorney is appointed to that case.
And this bill allows...
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, this bill would allow that Umatilla originally filed post-conviction relief case to remain in Umatilla County after the inmate is transferred to Malheur County.
Other questions? Thank you very
much,
Ann. Is there anybody else would like to testify on Senate Bill 45? Okay, hearing none, I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 45 and open a work session on Senate Bill 45.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'm going to move House Senate Bill 45 as presented to the committee to the floor with Steve Pat's recommendation.
Any discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Hummel?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Brzezinski?
Aye.
Representative Cheddarby?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Excused. What's the procedure?
We're excused.
So in terms of the wording for the Senate Bill 45, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed.
Carry.
Anybody want to carry?
I'll carry.
Okay. Representative Brzezinski will carry. All right. Next, we're going to... handle Senate Bill 46. Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 46 is going to have quite a few people here, so I think if I look at this real quickly, I'll try to see basically who's for and against it, so you know who's for it, and then maybe they can come up in group. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 46 deals with the definition of enter and remain for purposes of criminal trespassing. And specifically, it deals with that portion of entering or remaining unlawfully that deals with premises open to the public. And the reason that we have this bill is a case called State versus Lawrence Collins. And that case interpreted this section, and law enforcement believed after that there needed to be a change to the statute to deal with a person who enters a premises open to the public and is told to leave that premises open to the public by a person who's in charge and thereafter then comes back. And the issue is, when that person comes back to that premises, can you arrest that person? Or do you need to again say you have to leave so that then after they've been told to not come back, they come back again? That's basically the issue. This bill answers it that when they come back after being trespassed, they can be arrested and they are violating criminal trespass in the second degree. And so,
all right, thank you much. I'm going to call Kelly Skye and Lynn Marie Kreider.
She's the opponent, so they might want to start with the people for it first.
We'll go to the proponents first. Jonathan Fussner, Matt England, and let's bring everybody up. Laurie Abraham, Mike Salzgiver, and Jared Broadfoot. Maybe we can pull up a couple chairs. Thank you. Shall we go beauty before age, Ms. Abraham?
Go with age first.
Chair Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Fussner. I am the attorney in charge of criminal appeals in the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here on behalf of Senate Bill 46. The bill would correct a court decision that, in our view, was erroneous, made by the Court of Appeals in State versus Collins. The way the criminal trespass laws worked prior to this decision, it would be criminal trespassing if a person was in a public place, like a park, a public building such as Capitol Building, or any other public place, and was lawfully ordered to leave by a person in charge and refused to leave. That's one flavor of criminal trespass. The second way would be if the person was ordered to stay away from the premises. And this could be by a court order, could be by the person in charge of the premises simply telling them, I don't want you coming onto this property, or it could be because they were on the property, they were ordered to leave and not come back. If the person came back, that would be an act of criminal trespass, just as much as if they refused to leave in the first place. Without going into the details of how the Court of Appeals came to its conclusion, the Court of Appeals held that there is only one kind of trespassing. That's the first kind, where a person is on the public premises and is ordered to leave. The Court held that if a person comes onto the premises, such as comes back to the park that they've been excluded from, comes back into the Capitol Building after having been ordered to stay away, that's not the crime of criminal trespass. And it has created some very bizarre and difficult situations for law enforcement where you have people who are doing things like standing in public places beside highways where it's not open to pedestrians. An officer arrives and says, you have to step back, you have to go back over the fence, you can't stand here. Person does that, 5 minutes later they're back out there, the officer comes back, tells them they have to leave, and the cycle simply repeats itself, and there's nothing that can be done about it in terms of citing or arresting that person for trespassing when they come back. Very simply, Senate Bill 46 fixes that problem. It does so by adding a definition of enter or remain unlawfully that is very simple, and it says that includes to enter premises that are open to the public after being lawfully denied entry. And as I mentioned, this kind of lawful exclusion can come about through a court order, through police officers. For example, the city of Portland has had a number of city ordinances that enable the police to bar people from prostitution-free zones, drug-free zones, and city parks. If they violate the law in those zones, the exclusions operate for a period of months. And under current law, as interpreted by the Court of Appeals, those exclusion orders are essentially unenforceable. The final point that I'd like to make is that Senate Bill 46 does not change and is not intended to change the law other than to restore it to the way it was before the Collins decision. It's not intended to expand the criminal trespass statute, but simply to return it to where we all thought it was prior to the Collins decision. I might mention just one final footnote. The state petitioned the Oregon Supreme Court for review of the Collins decision. The Supreme Court has granted our petition, and so the Collins decision is currently being briefed, and it has not yet been argued in the Supreme Court. So it may turn out that fixing this Collins decision will not be necessary if the Supreme Court ultimately upholds the state's reading of the statute. However, I still would urge the members of the committee to pass Senate Bill 46 for two reasons. One is it may take quite a while for the Supreme Court to act. And the second is, even if the Supreme Court were to agree with the Court of Appeals, we still think that Senate Bill 46 accurately and correctly reflects what the Legislative Assembly meant to do when they enacted the criminal trespass statutes, and we should restore the law to that point.
Sorry. Members of the committee and Chairman, my name is Lori Abraham. I'm a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County and have been for about the last 20 years. And what the Collins decision did, in my opinion, is it completely gutted the deterrent effect that the Oregon trespass laws has allowed both public property but primarily private property to use to control public safety problems on their properties. As a prosecutor, part of my job is to work with private property owners to deal with ongoing criminal activity on their premises. And I want to give you some examples of what the Collins decision did for undercutting the ability of these private property owners to deal with their problems. An example is at a large department store in downtown Portland, they had to terminate an employee who had been threatening a number of other employees in the business. When they terminated this employee insisted that he was going to be coming back with a shotgun to kill people. And when they explained the circumstances of all this, they said to me, well, what are we supposed to do when he comes back? And I said, well, you're going to have to tell him to leave each and every time. Doesn't matter how many times he comes back, you're going to have to tell him to leave each and every time. What they wanted to do was, the minute they saw him coming in the door, was to back away themselves since he had threatened them as well and call the police and have the police come down there. But as Officer Matt Ingen will tell you, he's had to respond, as well as other officers of the Portland Police Bureau, to many private properties over the last year and almost a half now and tell them there was nothing they could do. The fact that these were repeat people who were coming back time and time again, there was nothing they could do about it. We have a number of libraries, both privately owned libraries, city-owned libraries, places where you can go read books or whatever. Lots of people, I found over time, I'm getting complaints from businesses that engage in book selling as well as libraries that are renting books, obviously, that people are in there doing things that aren't criminal but engaging in some sort of sexual behavior that isn't criminal. And with themselves, usually. And these people, they want to keep out of libraries, out of stores that are selling books and things, and they want to be able to keep them out and not allow them to come back in because of the consequences of maybe that person taking the additional step of deciding to do that to someone else. And they use an exclusion tool to do that. But if the person is allowed to keep coming back, there's really no teeth, again, no deterrent effect in the law. So the important thing, I think, for this committee to remember is that the trespass statute set up a deterrent effect. It allowed private property owners to say, you can't come onto my property when you engage in this kind of behavior. And if you come back, I'm going to call the police, and you're going to be arrested. Now, that solves some of the problems because some people will not come back. But the ones that do return, if you all of a sudden then have to keep approaching them and tell them every day not to come back, they soon figure out that, well, there's no teeth in this. I can just come back, and as long as I leave every time they ask me, it's no problem. And maybe I'll be able to accomplish what I want to accomplish before they find me and ask me to leave. So that's what I want to make sure you understand, is that there was a great deterrent effect here, and that's been undercut by the Collins decision. And I agree with the Attorney General's office and Jonathan Fessner that really what all this bill does is restore us back to the position we were in prior to the Collins decision. And I have a letter that I sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee responding to some of the concerns that were brought by the Oregon Defense Lawyers Association. And their concerns that they raised was that it criminalized new behavior, and that is simply not true, that if we go back to pre-Collins, this is what this bill does. It goes back to pre-Collins. The same behavior that was criminal then would be criminal again. And that's all that we want this bill to do, is just restore us back to the position that we were at. They had great concerns about ocean burglaries. I go through and explain that in my letter. Those the state legislature took out of the burglary statute, so you can read that. I think I I clarify why those kind of cases will not become burglaries again, because it's clearly set out in the statutes that they will not. So this bill does not affect ocean burglaries. And lastly, I want to point out that I do have representatives here from private properties that are here that are willing to testify, if you're so interested in it, concerning the problems that they have had since the Collins decision and the frustration that they have experienced with repeated criminal behavior, and yet nothing, obviously not criminal behavior according to Collins, but what they felt was criminal behavior, and there was nothing they could do. So I do have representatives from Pioneer Place, a shopping mall in downtown Portland, from Reliance Security Company, who handles a lot of security for small businesses, doctor's offices, small office buildings. I have security officers from Nordstrom's, Inc., as well as the Director of Operations of Portland Saturday Market, and also a building management company that manages buildings in Portland. They can all express to you their frustration if you are interested in hearing a testimony from them.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Salzgiver with the Portland Business Alliance. I will try to keep my remarks very brief. I appreciate the opportunity to provide business comments on SB 46. I'm not an attorney, but we have heard from a number of our members who are very interested in this law and in its administration. Lori has given you some terrific examples, so I won't repeat those. But I will tell you that the Alliance is a relatively new organization born of the merger from the Portland Chamber of Commerce and the Association for Portland Progress. Both organizations have been around for a long, long time. The Portland Chamber over 130 years. APP was over 30 years. Both organizations were very involved in central business district activities, business climate issues, and that's really what brings us here today. We support SB 46 because it will reinstate the original intent of Oregon's trespass laws. As you know, the Collins decision, as you've heard, effectively rendered Oregon's trespass laws meaningless and unenforceable. We support it because it allows them to be once again administered in a meaningful and effective way. One of our primary public policy objectives is to maintain and enhance a strong, positive business climate for our members. We do that through a self-financed business improvement district, so-called BID. We also are involved in a number of committees and task forces around the community that directly are involved in community well-being. Our clean and safe program supports that effort. We directly finance community court and other programs that we think are contribute directly in a creative and positive way to community positive community environment. Based on the comments we've received from our members, the Collins decision basically is impacting negatively the perception that Oregon and the Portland area is a good place to do business. We strongly encourage you to take what we think is a moderate and balanced approach in restoring the original law to its original intent, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
I think we'll take Mr. Ingen first.
Thank you. Chairman, committee members, thank you for your time. My name is Matt Ingen. I'm a police officer with the City of Portland. I will be brief, but I will be blunt. A couple of reasons why I'm here today. I represent the neighbors and businesses in Northwest Portland where I work. I also obviously am a police officer. This current case law has caused us a lot of consternation and a lot of frustration. It's fairly ridiculous in my mind that if a person is where they're not supposed to be, I tell you to leave, that's a pretty clear order, you should not come back. It shouldn't be, well, I'm going to step outside or I'm going to go around the block, I can come right back in and have to tell you to leave again. Imagine for whatever reason this room was a business parking lot or was a park or was a parking garage or some place that was open to the public, and you all, for whatever reason, shouldn't be here. Now, if I said, I'll leave and don't come back, that's a pretty unequivocal order. Now, that doesn't mean go outside and wait for me to leave and you come right back in. well, it just doesn't make sense. And that's essentially the game we play with transients, with car prowlers, with drinkers, with unwanted, whoever it may be. I tell them to leave, and they say, well, sure, officer, I'd love to leave. And they go ahead and leave. As soon as I'm out of sight or around the corner or a day later, an hour later, they're right back in there. And we play this game over and over and over again. I get calls every morning from businesses saying, hey, the same guy is asleep on my front stairs. He's gone to the bathroom. He's left his trash, and he's passed out. Can you come get him? Well, sure, I'll come out. I'll say, hey, Dirty Bob, you need to go. And Dirty Bob says, sure, officer, I'll be happy to leave. And he gets up and he leaves. And the next morning, he's right back there again. Now, it just doesn't seem right, and it doesn't seem logical. The word trespass means you're not supposed to be there. It doesn't mean you leave when you're told. It means you leave when you're told, and you don't come back for whatever prescribed length of time. The current law or Senate bill as proposed doesn't give us any broader powers, doesn't increase the penalties, doesn't change how we address it. It just changes it back to the day before Collins took effect. That's all I have to say. Do you have any questions?
Questions of the committee. Representative Przanski.
Thank you. I really just want to set a record because I think it's important that we know exactly what the extent is and what we're trying to get back to. In the city of Eugene, we have various zones where officers do have the authority by ordinance to not allow or to tell someone to leave based on their conduct, whatever that might be, prostitution, some areas, the mall that's in the downtown area. But there is also requirements within the ordinance that gives these individuals the opportunity to challenge that order. I just want to make certain on the record that we're not looking at trying to do away with that, that there still would be whatever safeguards are in place for individuals who are being ordered to leave a specific area to be able to challenge that if they think that, in this case, Officer Ingham, if you told someone, like you said, to leave a parking lot, under what authority you may be acting on as to whether it's within the color of law or whatever authority you may have as agent for that parking lot.
Chairman, sir, that's a good question. Now, as far as our zones, it's not going to change any ordinance or any wording in our whether it's prostitution or drug free or even exclusions from our parks. We address those violations currently through a city ordinance in lieu of trespass, and we also have built-in appeals and due process hearings for either appealing the hearing or the exclusion order. I think you believe you have 7 to 10 days to appeal those current orders. If I was acting as a person in charge of a private property, it's essentially up to the property owner to rescind that. Just like if I was acting as a person in charge for, say, B&B Auto Supply, which is where I have a lot of problems, it's just like I have the same rights and authority to remove a person from their front door as you would from your front door of your own house. And basically, the private owner has, godlike power in that right. I mean, they determine who's on the property and who doesn't. And this law doesn't affect or change that. It just takes it back to pre-Collins.
Right. Two other questions, if I could. Following up on that, I mean, what we have for our officers is an agency agreement with the landowner. The landowner can say for after business hours, the Eugene Police Department has the authority to enforce no trespassing on our property. And I'm assuming that's what the Portland Bureau has with certain businesses. They've signed some type of agreement that says that you can stand in their shoes and act as that. And doing that, do you tell them that you are under the authority of the store owner, you're requesting them or requiring them to leave?
Chairman, sir, yes. We have a business trespass agreement, which essentially states that in absence of an owner or a designated employee on the property, typically in the nighttime hours, that a police officer or designee will act as a person in charge. And if I were to contact the person the first time, I'd say, sir, this is private property, you need to leave. And I'd probably do that for first couple of times realistically. But then afterwards, I would have the authority after my second or third or contact and the person continues to come back onto the property that I could arrest for trespass. And the property owner, obviously, at any time has the ability to remove that agreement with the city or can decline to prosecute if they don't wish to.
Okay. One last question, if I could. This is more for Jonathan, maybe for the assistant DA. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
Yeah, Laura Abraham.
Thank you. My only concern is hearing the officer talk about how some of this is being done under ordinance. I also question, I guess I would just throw up as a heads up, what, if any, impact are we going to have if we start going in and defining the statute? Are we going to have some type of dollar hide or some other issue that may be brought up that we are now preempted the cities under the ordinances to being able to have something that may be contrary to what's now actually we've addressed in state statute?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kwasniewski, I'd like to respond to that by making it very clear that, in the first place, a person who has been excluded, whether it's by a police officer, by a court, or by anyone else, does have the right to challenge the lawfulness of that order. That was your first question. And that right was reaffirmed in a case decided in 2001, State versus Riddle. The Supreme Court denied review in that case. So that is the law, and Senate Bill 46 does nothing to alter that. So I think in any criminal trespass case, the lawfulness of the order excluding the person is always something that the defendant can challenge and that the state would have to prove. With respect to the dollar hide type preemption issue, I don't see this as creating that problem. We didn't have that problem prior to Collins, and I don't think that we'll have it after enactment of Senate Bill 46. The basic reason is when a person is prosecuted for criminal trespass under the state statute, which is all that this addresses, the only function, really, of all of these various city ordinances is simply to establish that the defendant was lawfully excluded from the property. And whether that exclusion came about through a city ordinance violation or a city ordinance procedure, or whether it came about simply, as Officer Engen was saying, it could be the business owner himself or herself telling the person to leave, really doesn't matter. The only function of those local ordinances is to establish that the reentry was unlawful. So it does not attempt to, and certainly the intent is not, to preempt in any way those ordinances.
Okay. But if I could, just one other one. And that really goes back to the officer. I received one email from someone from the Portland area saying they were concerned about this maybe expanding what is currently provided under an ordinance or under the state statute as to prohibiting someone in a drug-free zone area or a prostitution-free zone area. Does the Portland ordinance permit someone to be excluded from an area that they actually rightfully and lawfully live in? Or is there an exception to that?
I think I'll cover that again, Chairman and Representative Brzezinski. The way that the City of Portland wrote its ordinance is that if a person has, if there's probable cause for the police to believe that a crime, a drug crime or a prostitution type crime has been committed by this particular person, they are excluded from the public areas in that drug-free zone or that prostitution-free zone, the areas that are basically open to the city property, because the city is excluding them from their property, not from, you know, John Doe's property over here or, you know, their mother's property over here. It's from the city property. If they live in that area, they have an automatic right to come back into the zone to go to their place of residence. So that is built into the ordinance. And they can cross that city property to go to, of course, the place where they have a right to be, and they would not be arrested if they were going to that location.
Thank you for the clarity.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, I think, for Mr. Fussman. Am I correct that the Attorney General's office would be withdrawing the appeal if this measure were to become law?
Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen, I'm a little bit reluctant to give you a yes or no on that. The reason being that it may be that there are other reasons why we would like to pursue that appeal in the Supreme Court, simply as a matter of correcting the Court of Appeals' approach to statutory interpretation. But I think what more likely would happen would be that the Supreme Court might dismiss review on its own if this were to become law. The reason being that the court has done this before with a number of other cases where a legislative amendment to the statutes has basically fixed the problem that was created by a court of appeals opinion, and then the Supreme Court dismisses review on the grounds that, well, it's essentially a moot point now. So I think there's a possibility that the state would drop its petition for review if this were fixed, but I can't give you a firm yes or no on that. There's another point to be made here too, perhaps, and that is that, of course, the case involving Mr. Collins himself and a fair number of other cases that are in the pipeline would be affected if the state dropped its petition for review. In other words, Mr. Collins would have his conviction reversed. So there's that to consider. It's something we would certainly look at. But sorry about the long-winded response, but I can't give you a yes or no on it.
Just a comment, Chair. One of the things that kind of bothers me is the double kill that we get sometimes when we look at these problems. I'm not suggesting there is a problem here. I'm not suggesting one doesn't need to be addressed. But every time we use the court to solve one of the problems, it costs money, and every time we use the legislature to solve the same problem, it costs money. It would generally be my preference that one action be completed before another one has begun.
Further questions? Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Kelly Sky and Lynn Marie Kreider and Jared Broadfoot. Kelly, would you like to?
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Sky. I'm a legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we oppose Senate Bill 46 for a number of reasons. But the primary reason is that we oppose drug-free zones and prostitution-free zones and crime-free zones as they are used currently in the state of Oregon. And I don't know how much the committee, how familiar the committee is with the use of these zones, but there are large zones, for instance, in the Portland area that cover the entire downtown area and large portions of northeast Portland, large areas that primarily cover low-income neighborhoods. And it's from these neighborhoods that people can be excluded without ever having been convicted of a crime. And just because an officer has probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, an officer can write an exclusion excluding a person from their own neighborhood. Now, this may mean that they are allowed to live in their own house, but they can't grocery shop in their own neighborhood, and they can't go to the gas station in their own neighborhood. And at the public defender's office, we see these people routinely arrested for criminal trespass prior to the Collins case. For conducting business in their own neighborhood, constantly questioned for their presence. I personally represented a person at trial who was arrested on the sidewalk in front of his very own house because he was on the public portion of the sidewalk. Confirmed at trial, admitted by the police that he was in front of the house, his own house, and that they knew that he lived there, but he was arrested because he had been excluded from the drug-free zone, which is a place where he lived and had lived for a number of years. So when the proponents talk about the original intent of the criminal trespass statute, I have some concerns that probably the legislature, when they passed the criminal trespass statute, didn't envision that it was going to be used in the way that it's been used. If the legislature is to make that policy decision now, that's what they need to realize that they are doing. The court in Collins dealt with an issue, and that is notice. In order to prosecute somebody for violating an order, there has to be notice. And in requiring that a person be asked to leave the premises prior to being and fail to leave the premises prior to being actually arrested, what the court is saying is that person is given notice. They're asked to leave, and if they don't leave, then they are arrested. In some of the examples that were given by the Portland police officer who was present earlier, he talked about saying to someone, okay, you need to leave now from a particular piece of property. There's nothing in that request to leave that suggests that that person is not allowed to come back the following day. A lot of what happens with the criminal trespass prosecution revolves around actual notice. A lot of the problems that are discussed and that are tried or attempted to be handled through the criminal trespass prosecution deal with people who have committed crimes. Those people, once they have committed crimes, can be prosecuted for that crime, placed on probation, and as a condition of probation, ordered to remain out of certain areas or to follow certain rules or regulations. And as a result of violating those orders, they can be arrested and jailed on a violation of probation. So it's not necessary that we have criminal trespass prosecution. It's also important to understand the number of types of exclusions that this covers. There are these drug-free zones exclusions and prostitution-free zone exclusions. Many of those actually are in writing and do provide the dates for which they cover, but they also cover, you know, up to a year's period, and they can come from a number of different sources. The police can issue these exclusions. The courts can issue these exclusions as part of diversion programs, as part of probation. Merchants can issue exclusions from their property. Park officials can issue exclusions from their property. And the conditions and durations of all of these exclusions differ. Now, if one of us, one of the people in this room, were issued an exclusion, we would be able to read that exclusion and determine exactly the meaning of that exclusion, or even if we were told you are excluded from the Capitol building for 1 year from today, we would be able to process that information. But not everybody who is subject to these exclusions is able to process that information, and it's for that reason that that it's important that they be given notice, be asked to leave, told to leave, and if they fail to leave the premises, then they are subject to prosecution for criminal trespass. I am interested in the issue that Representative Jensen raises regarding the Collins appeal, and suggests that because the proponents claim that this is only intended to bring the law back to pre-Collins decision, perhaps what's appropriate if you do act on this now is to put in a sunset provision so that after the Supreme Court's had an ability to address the Collins decision, if they choose to fix it, this can sunset and cannot be used to expand the conduct which is being prosecuted under the criminal trespass statute. And we did have earlier concerns about the ocean burglaries. I'm somewhat satisfied by Ms. Abrams' letter, and she provided me a copy of that prior to this hearing today. And I think it's important that it be part of the record that ocean burglaries are not intended to be revived under the language of this current bill. That's all my comments.
Thank you. Ms. Kreider?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider. I'm research director at the Oregon AFL-CIO. And our concern is that the fix that is proposed in this bill may be considerably broader than what is intended by the proponents. Our concern is primarily that the new language appears not to deal just with a written exclusion order that's very clear about its parameters, but to say that when a person is lawfully denied entry to a place at one time, that any return in the future is criminal trespass. And our concern is that there are different circumstances. A person may be excluded at one time for one reason, and that doesn't necessarily mean that that person could expect that they would be denied access at another reason at a future time. My written testimony offers several instances, several of them from the labor context, since that's our particular concern, that, for example, an employee may be told that they shouldn't be on premises, at the employer's premises, during their off hours for some reason. That's generally okay, but the employee also has a federal right to be on premises during off hours in most circumstances if what he is doing is coming to talk to his coworkers on their breaks about union, for example. And I think an employer wouldn't necessarily expect that he could have someone arrested if they came back at a later time for a different purpose, but this language seems to say that. It strikes me that there are times in the public park that was offered as an example in some of the proponents' testimony may be illustrative, but say a particular public facility is closed to people for, there's a police line to control problematic behavior that's happening at a particular time, or the public space is being used at a, for a private purpose at one point, and therefore a person is denied entry. That doesn't mean that sometime later, that when the person comes back to Pioneer Courthouse Square or to a public park, that he has, he or she would have reason to expect that they could be arrested for criminal trespass, but it seems to me that this language simply says if you were denied once and later you return, you can be arrested. And I think that's broader than the committee would intend. Thank you.
Can be or will be? Can be arrested or will be arrested?
Well, clearly we would expect that if it seems to me we shouldn't create laws that we expect the police not to enforce because that would be bad public policy. We should be making laws that we want to be consistently enforced. And it seems to me if you make a law that says you're excluded at one time, then you can never come back without threat of criminal trespass, that's a bad law.
Okay. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot, representing Oregon gun owners. We have no position. We're neutral on Senate Bill 46, but do want to raise some concerns. Anytime we deal with criminal trespass and the words that we're interested in is being lawfully denied entry, we have had problems over the past several years with specifically the city of Portland trying to lawfully deny access to persons who are in possession and licensed under the concealed handgun statutes, legally possessing a concealed handgun licensed under statute and being denied access because they do possess a concealed handgun. We wanted to put on the record and reiterate that under ORS 166.370, that the possession of a firearm or dangerous weapon in a public building or court facility is prohibited, but there is exceptions, and one of those exceptions, which is in Section 3, Subsection D, a person who is licensed under ORS 166.291 and 166.292 to carry a concealed handgun. And then, of course, those statutes cite the concealed handgun statute. So what our intent and what our concern was is that we put on the record that is not lawful to deny access to a public place to someone who is licensed under those under 166.291 and 292 to carry a concealed handgun. And with those comments, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have, but that's why we have no position on this bill. It does not affect gun owners, we feel, but we have had a problem in the past, like I said, with different police agencies or cities feeling that they could legally deny someone access with a concealed handgun.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
Representative Shetterly.
I've been trying to process what we've heard here, both from the proponents and opponents. I represent a couple of school districts, and occasionally we have issued notices to somebody not to come on. Somebody has been
disruptive or violent. And so it's been my practice. I think what I heard is that you generally want to do this in writing so that it's clear that you've given the notice and that everyone understands what the limitations are. And I'm wondering if it would be helpful to propose something in the way of just for discussion to see if this addresses your concerns too, where it's a, rather than lawfully denied entry, if we were to say lawfully directed in writing not to enter premises, and then you can even put a durational limit on there too. I'm not so concerned about for a specific purpose. That to me invites game playing. You know, I didn't come on for this purpose. I came on for another purpose, and I'm not sure that I'm interested in necessarily looking at the purpose. But I don't know. I'd be interested in getting some feedback on that. If you're on the premises and you're being told, clearly that's immediate. You're being told to leave. That's immediate, and there's no likelihood of any misunderstanding as to what that means. But if you're being told today that you can't come back here, I think it's a legitimate question for how long, and I would think that for prosecution purposes, it'd be helpful to have something in writing so that there's a record of notice having been given. Now, they could obviously say they didn't get it, but again, I would expect that the person giving notice would keep a copy of the notice delivered, and I don't think we need to get specific as to how the notice is delivered. Just some element of that. I throw that out anyway.
Any discussion? Representative Przanski.
More of a question and also a question as to the perspective. McKelly, this may be going to some of the stuff that you brought up. I realize the issue, as from my perspective, dealing with private owners of property. We have EPD officers who cannot at this point enforce their agency agreement under the Collins decision, and at the same time also recognize the issue that you've raised regarding these free zones probably weren't contemplated. I was just looking to see when the statute was updated in 99, but was previously was 71, I guess, when the criminal code was actually organized and put into one body of law. So, I mean, realizing that you have some concerns as to how, let's say, this area has been broadened by these free zone areas, how else would we deal with the issues that private owners have where they have actually entered agency agreements with local law enforcement to be able to enforce no trespassing on their property after business hours?
Well, Chair Anderson, Representative Przanski, I think that those situations are the situations that cross over with Ms. Kreider's concerns, and because those are the situations where the person's being given only oral notice. And so I think that those situations are problematic. The notice that was given, that the police officer who sat here earlier testified to was, you need to leave now. Okay, fine, I'll leave. That's not adequate notice in order to prosecute someone for criminal trespass. How we can ensure that that person is given adequate notice is a very difficult proposition, and I think that Representative Shetterly is correct that in trying to put all of that into the criminal trespass statute, that would be very difficult and would probably tie people's hands more than necessary, although the concerns that we've raised are as to notice. And if you're going to prosecute someone, notice is a problem. They need to have notice, and the prosecution needs to be able to prove that there is notice. And I think that is part of why the court looks to this subsection B, that you be asked to leave and that you fail to leave, because that's very clear notice. How the police agency can enforce those agreements, you know, it may be that they have to be able to write out notices and keep copies of them. It's always going to be a problem because, just as we see in the drug-free zones, you know, how are the officers going to know who's excluded and who's not? Well, some of them may have memories of particular people that they've spoken to, but the next officer who drives by isn't going to know. And how are they going to be able to check and determine if this person who's sleeping on this property is the same person that his partner excluded the day before? I think that's always going to be a problem, and I don't know that there's a way that we can legislate that or codify it.
Representative Barker.
Hey, Mr. For the private businesses that are here, usually when they catch a thief, they give them a written exclusion telling them not to come back, and now what happens is they come back, and then Matt has to go out and say, you have to leave again, and then the guy leaves and he comes back the next day. That's what I think they're trying to get at, the commercial businesses. They're having not just the trespass, but the actual criminal activity. And the same, actually, with the drug-free zone there, they're given a written notice. I can see the concerns where it seems a little too broad to say if they've ever been told not to come in. That isn't what that's trying to address, I don't believe. But, for example, Kelly, do you know, and I'm asking because I don't, what's the limit on shoplifting before they'll be prosecuted in Multnomah County?
Well, currently, they don't have the money to appoint attorneys, so they're not prosecuting them.
So the businesses then would want to say, instead of going through all that hassle, they might, even if they were prosecuting, just say, don't come back here. I'm Fred Meyer. Stay out. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem?
I don't think that that's a problem for a private business to exclude an individual, to give them written notice, and certainly, you know, that person is not welcome there. The question becomes how we're going to word that in the law to coincide with the other kinds of notice that we're talking about, and I think it's there that you sweep in some conduct that it's difficult to codify the differences that we're talking about, but perhaps it is something that's more properly dealt with in the courts, as in State versus Collins. The courts can, you know, sometimes you can't define in the statute exactly what it is that you're getting to, and it has to be defined by case law or just at trial as to whether or not someone's guilty. And when it comes down to notice, that's what we're talking about, whether this person has notice and whether that can be proven at trial. I don't know if that answers.
Representative Brzezinski and then Representative Shirley.
I guess following with Representative Barker. The stores I work with, such as Bi-Mart, Safeway, Fred Meyer's, when they have someone that commits a theft, their officers or their agents do, in fact, go through this checklist before the cops even get there and will actually tell them, you're prohibited from coming on the property, and they'll have them sign it. And it is one that's unlimited in time, and it's not until they get written permission from the store after that time before they're actually supposed to come back. And a lot of times when I'm making offers to those individuals, I will try to make certain that they realize that if you go back to that store, they can arrest you. And I think the Collins decision has no bearing on those type of arrests because those, in fact, the person has been given notice. And, I mean, at least for me, document-wise, I've not declined for taking those cases forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I still think I like directed not to enter better than denied entry. Denied entry is so passive. Directed not to enter is active voice, and it also tracks with the language in sub B immediately above there where it says being lawfully directed to do so. So you're directing someone to leave, and then if you incorporate that directed not to enter, you're making it much more the active voice kind of thing. And Kelly, I'm not sure as we talk here that the statute necessarily needs to get specific as to the manner in which that direction is given. I think that's probably a prosecution issue, and if you want to be able to get a conviction, you're going to be able to need to show notice. I mean, that's going to be an element of the offense. So, you know, this isn't a civil process statute. It's not part of the rules of civil procedure. This is just, you know, if you've been directed not to come onto the premises, then you're subject to being charged with criminal trespass. And it's really going to be a matter for the prosecution to be able to show that notice was that you were in fact directed. And if they can't do that, and it's going to make the prosecution problematic. So I think there's an incentive, even without getting too bogged down in the details of how notice is given, as long as we make it that kind of directive language, I think we may be getting to pretty much what we need to get to. I mean, I want to be able to. I think I'm very sensitive and sympathetic to what the proponents of the bill are trying to do. I do think that just being denied entry is, I'm not sure that that's quite the language we want to go to, but something that address as being directed not to enter, and then really it's going to be a matter of the prosecution to prove the element of the offense and that the person had notice that they were not to be on the premises. And obviously a written notice is going to be the best way to do that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McPherson.
I want to understand the AFL-CIO's concern more fully, Emery. It appears that the concern is that a criminal statute will be used in order to inappropriately suppress labor organizing activities. Am I grasping that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I think any time that a statute is written more broadly than you intend to enforce it, then there's a possibility of selective and abusive use of that. I think some of this discussion about notice is helpful. I mean, the way we read this is that if you were denied entry at one time, then you could subsequently, because you were denied entry, you could be prosecuted later. It sounds like there's an assumption among the law enforcement folk in the room, and perhaps the committee as well, that the denial of entry needs to be in force at the time, which clearly seems correct to me, and therefore Representative Shetterly's suggestion that it might need to be in writing or it might need to state its duration would be helpful. Maybe there is some other way than that to make it clear in this language that we're not talking about, that we are talking about a denial of entry that is still in effect at the time that the person is arrested for criminal trespass. That's our concern, is really that times shift, and there are reasonable reasons for excluding someone at one point, that especially from public property, I would think, that would not necessarily hold true at a later time, and that it's important that the law not be written so broadly that folks can be arrested for criminal trespass when, in fact, they had no reason to believe they were doing anything wrong.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Would a structure in the statute that required notice, whether written or oral, that would that could be indefinite in duration, and it sounds like to me as though that would be a typical situation, would be for an indefinite duration, but which was sufficiently specific that an individual would know that they were on notice. Would that be sufficient to allay the concern?
I think that would be helpful, yes. I think it, that gives you something that you can challenge, or you can go back to the owner and say, geez, you know, I got this several years ago. It didn't seem like it should apply in this circumstance, and they can have a discussion. But if you don't know until you're arrested, then you can't deal with it. So, yes, I think something that required notice with clarity about duration would be helpful, okay. whether oral or written, although for the property owner's benefit, it would probably be better that it be written.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, no further discussion. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on 46A, Senate Bill 46A? All right, hearing none, considering the suggestions that Representative Shetterly has made and several others, we'll close the hearing and bring this back for work session at a later time. I'd like to bring up Randy Covey for Senate Bill 65.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I have to miss this, but I have a medical appointment I need to catch up to.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Lieutenant Covey's getting seated. Senate Bill 65 deals with a situation that last session there was this bill that came through the judiciary, Senate Bill 370, I believe it was, that dealt with prohibiting having sexual contact with an animal. That bill went through last session, and unfortunately, between then and now, there have been situations where, for lack of a better word, the animal is being caused to have contact with a human, and that is what this bill is to address.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Lieutenant Randy Covey, I'm here today representing the Law Enforcement Division of the Oregon Humane Society. Worked in the law enforcement aspects of animal welfare crimes for about 15 years. And occasionally we have a bill or a law that comes along that we think we have addressed adequately first time through, and this is an example of one that we apparently overlooked a potential issue. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 65, and which modifies the crime of sexual assault of an animal. Counsel has adequately described the issue in that the original law that was passed last session simply addressed people touching animals, certain parts of animals, for a person's own sexual gratification, but it overlooked the fact that people that practice bestiality oftentimes have the animal touch them for the same purpose. And so it clarifies that and makes that also a part of the crime. It's not an issue that anybody likes to talk about or think about, but it is an issue that occurs. It happens, and those of us that are charged with enforcing the laws like to have the tools to be able to do that adequately. For that reason, I urge you to support this modification of the crime and support Senate Bill 65.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I think we'll close the hearing, and I'm going to bring this back for a work session on the request of the chairman of the committee. And I think several wanted to vote on it as well. All right. So our last is Senate Bill 67.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just observed, I see this was placed on the consent calendar in the Senate. I can only imagine why.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, real briefly, moving on as quickly as I can. Senate Bill 67 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. Wendy Johnson's here to talk about this. Briefly, Oregon statute provides that testimony can be taken in civil cases by phone testimony. This would allow that to occur for a juvenile case, specifically not for a delinquency case, which is a criminal case, but a dependency case where the state is intervening so that there is a because there's a risk of harm to that child, or later at the point where the state is seeking to terminate the rights of parents. This bill would allow for phone testimony.
Thank you. Did you say Ms. Johnson was going to testify briefly?
I think she'd love to testify briefly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. As counsel explained, this bill was pre-session filed with the Judiciary Committee on behalf of the Law Commission. It's a bill that comes out of the Juvenile Code Work Group, chaired by Senator Kate Brown. We've brought a number of bills before you. This is one of our simpler ones. It's six words, and it just makes it very clear that in the case of juvenile dependency matters, telephone testimony can be used. The statute is ORS 45.400. Last session, the phrase civil proceeding was used. Some attorneys would say that juvenile dependency matters are swept under that civil proceeding language. Others would say that it's not. So these new six words would make it crystal clear that telephone testimony is permitted for juvenile dependency matters. It's a cost-saving issue. The chair of the work group, Ted Meese from the Department of Justice, wanted to make sure that I made that point, that if we have to stop using telephone testimony in dependency matters, the costs around the state would go significantly higher as we use expert witnesses in a number of these cases, especially psychologists and such. It is a consensus bill. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, all clear. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on Senate Bill 67? Okay, hearing none, we'll close the hearing. And I believe we will adjourn.
Oh.
Do you want to...
let's do this one.
Yeah.
Work session?
Yes.
All right, I'll open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
With Representative Shirtland.
Move Senate Bill 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Excused.
Yes. Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kuzanski?
Aye.
Representative Cheddarby?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye. Senate Bill 67, having obtained a constitutional majority, is declared passed. And with that, we do adjourn. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll carry it.
Want to?
Sure.
Okay. We'll assign the carrying to Representative Shirley. And we are adjourned after several tries.